It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and thanks to Sarah Gonzalez for filling in while I was in Washington, D.C. for a speaking engagement at the annual convention of journalism professors, the AEJMC. I'll report a few little things from there. First of all, journalism is not dead. Based on the number of people teaching it and studying it, the conference was absolutely bursting with people from hundreds of colleges and universities all over the country. And even as the Daily News and other places slash the number of jobs, even as the President of the United States calls journalists the enemies of the people, and maybe because of that, students are signing up to go to journalism school. It's a testament to the human spirit, really. If you are going to be vilified and you can't make a living, that you choose to major in that. And if you don't want to take my word for it, here's a Wall Street Journal headline from April. The rise of, quote, fake news is producing a record number of journalism majors. By the way, one thing that had the J School profs shaking their heads down there, at least the ones I talked to, was the news museum in Washington called the Newseum. It was selling fake news T-shirts. Maybe you've heard this. It may seem like a tongue-in-cheek satire to them, but the people I talked to thought too many folks around the country wouldn't get the joke, and that Trump smear of the press would just start to run deeper. And guess what? The Newseum has now pulled that shirt from their gift shop. I did hear one version of it, though, from one of the journalism profs who said they came up with that T-shirt before Trump started calling the media fake news, when the real fake news story, that is Russian fake news during the 2016 election, first surfaced, and fake news wasn't turned on its head by Trump to refer to the real news. That's when they produced the T-shirt. But nevertheless, they were selling it recently when everybody knows how it's being used. So a couple of pieces of wisdom from two cab drivers I had the pleasure to have conversations with in D.C. One, I wonder if sometimes we in the press overstate the amount of polarization in Washington right now. I've wondered that. I've wondered it aloud on the air. It was bad during Clinton. It was bad during Bush. It was bad during Obama. It was bad back in the 60s. But I had a cab driver who's been on the job 12 years anyway, and he said he's never seen it like this. He hears people talking in his taxi about every little destination in partisan terms, like that's a Democratic restaurant or a Republican restaurant. We can't go there. And it wasn't like that before. And that same driver told me that Uber in D.C. is really kicking the rears of the traditional taxi drivers, just like here in New York. He pointed out to me the line of cars waiting outside the Amtrak station, Union Station, and that it stretched for dozens and dozens of cars all the way down one block and around another. I saw it with my eyes after he pointed it out. We don't even see that in New York. We don't see that at Penn Station, for example. But it was that bad in Washington because Uber is cutting into the riding around town business so heavily. And later this morning on today's show, we'll talk about the first in the U.S. cap and minimum wage for Uber and other cab drivers that you've probably heard City Council here in New York enacted yesterday. This is a big local story, but also way bigger than a local story for the precedent it sets. And as you bemoan the state of the New York City subway system, think about this from the other taxi driver I had. He said DC's Metro, which people in New York sometimes cite as something to aspire to, he said the DC system might be clean and reliable, but he prefers New York's because the Washington DC system doesn't go anywhere. Huh. He said New York's is a real subway system because it goes so many places that a lot of New Yorkers really don't need a car. In D.C., so many people still do, and traffic is horrible because the subway, he said, doesn't go anywhere. Of course, I didn't ask him about NJ Transit, but that's another show. Anyway, there's a little taxi driver wisdom from my little trip to D.C. So who's going to run that little D.C. institution known as Congress next year? The results from various elections around the country on Tuesday lean Democrat but are inconclusive. Two biggies in Ohio and Kansas are still too close to call here on Thursday morning after the Tuesday vote. Beyond the results themselves, however, there are also interesting angles as they pertain to Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and even the Mueller investigation. So let's talk to Politico 2018 midterms reporter Elena Schneider. Hi, Elena. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
First, what's the status as we speak of the closely watched special House race in the suburbs of Columbus, Ohio? Republican Troy Balderson, where Trump came to campaign for him last week against Democrat Danny O'Connor. It's a district Trump won by 11 points and has been Republican for most of 30 years. What's the status of that race?
So right now it's still wait and see. So Ohio state law actually requires a couple of days in between when the election is held and when the counties can actually start counting those provisional and absentee ballots, which we've still got about 8,000 of them left to be counted at this point. So we're still waiting. And it's not going to be clear yet as to whether or not that's going to be enough to make up a gap or trigger a potential recount. But at this point, both sides are basically acknowledging that Balderson has, in fact, won this race, even if it's not quite official yet.
And my reading of the math is very much, I guess, along the lines of everybody else's, that it's on Balderson's side here, that the provisional ballots would have to break in such a high percentage for the Democrat that it's just unlikely, unless they're all from a very few, very Democratic neighborhoods, right?
Exactly. So at this point, it looks like Troy Balderson is going to be heading to Congress. But that being said, it's a short period that he'll be in charge or he'll be in office. He's got to start running for re-election. And both Balderson and Danny O'Connor have made it clear that they're going to be seeking a rematch in November. So we're going to get a repeat of all of this almost immediately.
Much probably to the chagrin of a lot of people in Ohio, just that they're going to have to go through it all again right away.
Exactly.
A lot of the press coverage is that these results are encouraging for the Democrats, discouraging for the Republicans in any case, because it was basically a tie in a very Republican district. But I feel like I've heard that before in some other special elections that Republicans have narrowly won. The Dems aren't, you know, I want to get your take on this, because really the Democrats won't take the House unless they actually win two dozen Republican seats, not just come closer than in the past. So how do you see the implications of Balderson O'Connor, if any?
I think you make a fair point, and you're also, you know, definitely saying something that I hear a lot often from Republicans, and you'd hear it from Democrats too if they were in the opposite position, which is a win is a win is a win. At the end of the day, Democrats did not notch a win in Ohio, and they certainly came close, but like you said, they actually need to start winning these races if they're going to flip the House. Now, that being said, the Democrat pushback on that is that these are places where Republicans want to have special elections. So these are typically places where you're pulling members of Congress to be in the administration or who feel comfortable to retire early because their seats are traditionally safe. So presumably, these wouldn't be at risk, not only in a general election, but also in a special election where there's going to just be a lot less attention focused on it. So that's why these members of Congress, you know, from Georgia, when Tom Price was pulled in to be HHS secretary briefly, where we had a special down there, out in Montana for interior secretary, these are all places that they're supposed to win easily. So these shrinking margins and these very close calls, and even obviously in Pennsylvania, where they did actually notch a victory for Democrats and flipped a House seat, that this is evidence and continued sustained evidence of the kind of Democratic energy that they're going to need to flip the House. And I'll say one more point on Ohio. You know, they came very close, but this is a very, you know, like I said, traditional Republican district that has not had a Democrat represent it for, you know, decades at this point. And there are about 70 House seats that are more competitive, more sort of look better on paper than this Ohio seat. So that's a pretty enormous playing field that Democrats can work with, and that's why they feel really good about what they saw last night.
One follow-up. You mentioned, as we know if we've been following it, that this was a special election to fill an open seat. They run against each other again in November. Do you think a narrow Republican win, assuming it does finally turn out that way, advantages either candidate in the November rerun?
It's a good question. I think given how short of a period of time ahead of the election, it's really still a draw. I mean, Balderson is going to come in with a little bit of an advantage just simply by being able to ride in on some of that momentum. And arguably, maybe there might be, you know, an argument to be made that, you know, given how traditionally Republican is, maybe that he has a bit of an edge if the turnout is a little bit bigger in a midterm cycle. But, you know, I think at the same time, Democrats would push back on that, say, look, that there is a very good chance that even higher Democratic turnout in a midterm cycle, given the intensity and the energy that we've seen coming from them. So at this point, I think it's almost a draw.
My guest is Elena Schneider, campaign reporter for Politico, where she's focusing these days on midterm House and Senate races. And we can take your phone calls with your thoughts or questions for Elena Schneider about the implications of Tuesday's primaries in various states and special general election like in Ohio. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or anything related. One thing related, I wonder if you have a take yet on the Chris Collins situation. For people who haven't heard that story, I think a lot of folks waking up Wednesday morning and expecting the big midterms House race story to be this Ohio one were a little shocked to hear that a Republican congressman from Buffalo, Chris Collins, was indicted on securities fraud charges, insider trading, for allegedly calling his son from the White House, by the way, when he was there with Trump on an event. Chris Collins, who in fact was the first member of Congress to endorse Donald Trump in 2016. So that's the kind of Republican he is. In what's considered a safe district, the Buffalo area upstate here. But now he's indicted on this, from the headlines, from the descriptions, very credible charge of insider trading of a company that he's on the board of, and he got word of a big drug company, drug trial failure, and immediately, within seconds, notified his son to dump the stock before the public was allowed to hear about it. At least that's the allegation. And yet this is a very Republican district, and he's going to stay in the race, he says. So for you, covering the midterms, even with such a serious infraction, if he turns out to be guilty, do you see this race as favoring a Democrat now?
Well, look, this district voted for Donald Trump by about 25 points. This is upstate New York. This is a traditionally definitely a very Republican district, much tougher than, say, even the two special elections, Pennsylvania and Ohio, that we just had. That being said, though, Nate McMurray, the Democrat who's running against him, tweeted out yesterday that he's raising more money than he ever expected out of this news, and that's not really a shock. There's certainly going to be some online attention on trying to support this Democratic candidate to take on Chris Collins. But I think that regardless of whether or not this specific district becomes competitive, which it seems, you know, unlikely, and look, Michael Grimm from Staten Island, who was elected while he was under indictment. So it's not that we're without precedent of this sort of thing happening in New York. But I think what it goes to is a larger messaging strategy about corruption and about draining the swamp, which certainly Democrats want to take that message from the Republicans and from Trump specifically and use it themselves. And we even actually wrote about this back in August of last year during the during when Duncan Hunter, a California Republican congressman, was sort of hauled in to sort of do some preliminary interviews about a potential. He's not been indicted at the moment, but certainly has been there's been interviews around some of his campaign spending, that there's this way to talk about corruption and draining the swamp that Democrats can use that connect that to both Trump and also members of Congress. And running on that message is really potent, and it's one they ran on in 2006. So this gives another data point, another piece of evidence where they can say, look, these guys aren't trustworthy and they're using their positions of power to make money. And neither party likes that. Neither sets of voters like that. And it's going to potentially be a very potent messaging in November.
All right. The other race still too close to call is the Republican primary for governor of Kansas. Now, people here in greater New York may be asking, how does this concern me? Can you tell us why that's considered an indicator for control of Congress, a Republican primary for governor of Kansas?
So this is it's fair question. I think how it relates is just the power of Trump's endorsement, whether or not it's as potent and as important of a way to excite the base as maybe it was even just a year ago when he intervened in the Alabama Senate special election primary. So Trump, much to, I think, the chagrin of some of the Kansas Republicans who hoped that he would stay out of this race, he ended up tweeting his endorsement of Kris Kobach, who's this immigration hardliner, somebody who's really become famous for his attacks on, you know, on voting and voter, you know, Democrats would say voter suppression.
Let me jump on that,
sure,
for
please.
A second, because I have a clip. Kobach, for those of you who don't know, is famous for being the leader of the so-called commission to study the so-called voter fraud epidemic that Trump so-called claims cost him the popular vote. Here's Kobach.
I'm simply saying that in my state, we have discovered a problem, but no commission has ever looked at it from a nationwide perspective.
And nor has anybody ever discovered an actual problem that could throw any election, certainly not the presidential vote. So in famously conservative Kansas, they may nominate a Republican for governor who's too much of a radical firebrand even for them. Is that the story here, Elena?
That's basically the story. The lieutenant governor who took over for Brown back when he went into the Trump administration, Jeff Collier, he's the sort of presumed incumbent. He's sort of your typical conventional Republican candidate. And he's somebody who certainly Kris Kobach has tried to outmaneuver from the right. And if Kobach wins, then Democrats really do feel like they have a better shot at this Kansas gubernatorial office, which would be quite a big deal. In a state that's as red as Kansas is, but certainly this race is coming online in a way that I think nobody really expected after Kobach was endorsed.
This is the race, by the way, where Trump himself came out in support, as you say, and made this false comparison to falsely suggest the need for photo IDs for shopping at grocery stores.
You know, if you go out and you want to buy groceries, you need a picture on a card. You need ID.
You do not need a photo ID to buy groceries in Kansas or anywhere in America, just for the record. Let me go on, Elena. My guest is Elena Schneider from Politico, as we talk about the midterms broadly and with respect to the results from Tuesday's various elections. Let me go on to some of the other trends that we're seeing from this round of elections in various states on Tuesday. One is that Donald Trump, as we've been saying, and also Nancy Pelosi, continue to be used as scary monsters by the opposite parties. And I think we all know how Democrats might use Trump. How do Republicans try to make a scary monster out of Nancy Pelosi, as specifically as you could say?
Republicans have been using Nancy Pelosi as a boogeywoman for a number of years now. And she's somebody who they've used through campaign ads to very effectively paint as this sort of California liberal, socialist, fair or not, woman who represents for them all the sort of coastal elite issues that they say is going to drive away moderates and independents from liking the Democratic Party. She's sort of the perfect symbol of that. And should they, in part, been able to do that because they've spent millions and millions of dollars painting her that way, fair or not. And Democrats have realized that this is a real weight on them. She's a very toxic figure. in a lot of these House districts. And so connecting Democratic candidates to her is problematic. So part of what we're seeing Democratic candidates do to try and neutralize that attack line is to say they don't plan on supporting her for speaker or for leader of the Democratic Party. Sort of the tagline we hear is we want new leadership in both parties. That's a way that almost two dozen different Democratic candidates across the country has said that they're not going to support her. So this is a really interesting trend that we've seen manifest after the Pennsylvania special election, in which Connor Lamb really effectively used that sort of messaging tactic to hold together a lot of a loose coalition of both Democrats, but also a lot of Republicans who said, hey, if he's a new kind of Democrat, then I want to support him.
And I saw your article on that on Politico called Democratic Candidates Vow to Dump Pelosi. Here's an example of that from a campaign commercial for Democratic candidate Clark Tucker in Arkansas.
Congressman Hill opened his campaign by attacking me, knowing full well that I've said from day one that I won't vote for Nancy Pelosi. We're better than that.
And that's the Democrat saying that. But on the policy level, let me ask the policy question again. We know Trump is associated in Democrats' eyes with racist immigration policies and trying to lean us toward authoritarianism, for example. We know how Democrats run against Trump at the policy level. What policies do the Republicans associate with Nancy Pelosi that they try to instill fear of, or is it largely sexism?
I think that they try to associate her with Obamacare and with what they would call socialized medicine and extending that into things like single payer system, which obviously Obamacare is not. And certainly wasn't necessarily from the beginning. But that's how they sort of connect her policy-wise to something that Republicans really don't like. And that's what started back in 2010 and hasn't really changed since then.
Let's take a phone call. Tom in Seabright. You're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Tom. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if there's, I read a recent article that 80% of the people in this country live paycheck to paycheck. Why can't there be the Democratic establishment give up what they've been doing, I guess, identity politics, trying to cobble together some sort of win now and then, and run directly against what the Republicans stand for, which is low taxes, privatization, deregulation, and trickle down. They've been saying that since Reagan. They've been trying to destroy the New Deal since it came into existence. Why don't they demonize the Koch brothers? Why don't they demonize the people that fund these evil, these AstroTurf campaigns, the ALEC, everything? They don't. I don't think they want to undermine the economic system here. But I think if they did, if they painted a different world view for the workers and the people that are struggling, I think they'd get a lot of votes. I think they'd win and they'd beat the Republicans because, as people have said before, we are many and they are few. So I'd like to know what you guys think about that.
Tom, thank you. Elena?
Well, look, I think a lot of these candidates are trying to talk about exactly what you're saying, which is a concern that Republicans are going to take away funding for Medicare and for Social Security. They've spent a lot of time attacking these Republican tax cuts that they passed back in December. So I think that the candidates themselves on a district-by-district level, in the TV ads that you're seeing them put out and start to put out in preparation for the general election, they do talk about those issues. The harder part is that breaking through this cycle in which we've got a White House that is constantly sucking up all of the attention and all of the oxygen in the room, it's just hard for these House candidates to get their to get their message through, to have people really see it and hear it. And that's not the fault of the House candidates, and it's not something that's all that different from what we see. Normally, the White House is often directing and determining the direction of the conversation in the media. So it's not surprising that these House candidates sort of have trouble breaking through. But I think on a district-by-district level, they are talking about it. And I think that that's something that if they're going to win, they're going to win by pointing out that maybe the tax cuts aren't doing everything the Republicans say that they might. They do sometimes, I think, wander off into criticizing Trump. And I think that that's where it gets a little problematic. I think it's all about tying in. If they want to convince voters to vote for them, they've got to tie in sort of the Trump chaos to a policy issue, too.
To Tom's point, also being written about since Tuesday's elections in various media is how Bernie Sanders has not been scoring very high in races where he endorsed Democratic primary challengers. I think it probably would be safe to say, based on his particulars, that the callers from the Bernie wing, if you will, of the Democratic Party. And similarly, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, despite her primary victory here in New York and her fast rise to political stardom, has backed at least four underdog losers recently in four different states, far from the Bronx and Queens. Now, I have a theory that these numbers might miss a bigger picture of the power of the Bernie and Ocasio-Cortez wing. But what did you see Tuesday regarding Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing or progressive wing candidates generally?
So there were two candidates that I was watching in particular to test just how they performed in Tuesday's election. So Brent Welder, who was a Sanders supporter and actually had Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez come down and campaign for him in a House race in Kansas City, he lost his Democratic primary. He came in second to Charisse Davids, a woman, an openly gay person who's just got this really fascinating story, but he wasn't able to break through there, even though he came very close. And then Abdul El Sayed, who is the Michigan gubernatorial candidate in that Democratic primary, again, somebody who got both Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez to stump for him. He lost as well. And so I think both of those candidates, again, that's part of why we saw a couple headlines about Bernie Sanders sort of sputtering here with some of his endorsements. But I think you're right. The bigger picture is that in every single House race that I have covered in all of these Democratic primaries, in almost all of them, there was a candidate who was more in the Bernie Sanders vein of the party, somebody who was talking about Medicare for all, who was talking about raising the minimum wage to $15, who was talking about free college. And that person helped drive the conversation and move the party a little bit to the left. And I think, you know, I was just talking to Ben Tulchin, who was Sanders' pollster back in 2016. And he acknowledged, look, we're not going to win all of these. But the point is that we have these candidates in these races who help shade the platform a little bluer. And I think that that's more of what the Sanders groups can point to as their victory, is that they've moved the platform to the left in the same way that Bernie Sanders was able to do in the 2016 presidential race.
I think you're right. And here's Ocasio-Cortez campaigning for the losing candidate in Michigan's Democratic gubernatorial primary, Abdul El Sayed, who could have become the nation's first Muslim governor.
Abdul is the only candidate in this race that rejects corporate money and has the courage to stand up for improved and expanded Medicare for all, for addressing people's pocketbook issues.
So that candidate lost, but she didn't only get behind losers. Here she is for James Thompson, who won a Kansas congressional primary.
You all are very lucky and very blessed to have James Thompson as a candidate, to have a man that so truly cares for the needs of working class people and fights for the dignity of his neighbors. We're very lucky.
And he won. So I would add, Elena, to what you said about Bernie Sanders, that I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not out for a win-loss record right now. She's staking her claim and helping others in a young, emerging wing of the party raise their profiles. And so to some of the articles I've been seeing, winning this week is actually overrated as an indicator of her and her allies' growing influence and appeal.
And I think what they also have a huge ability to do is fundraise online. And I think that that's why, you know, they want to put their stamp of approval on candidates to win, because, you know, obviously that is a good way to keep raising money. But it also is just a way for them to put people on the map, to show how many of these kinds of candidates are out there and how they're shifting the party. So I think you're totally right to say it's not so much about win losses, even though ideally they do want wins, but that's not sort of the be all end all for them. They just generally want to move the party to the left.
Now, an indication of some of the divide within the Democratic Party that we've seen in some of these primaries, did you notice in the call we just got from Tom in Seabright talking about how the Democrats should run against these Republican special interests and on class-based economic interests or issues, he said, and stop focusing so much on identity politics. Well, we have a few callers who want to speak back to him on that, and we're going to let Sherry in Long Island City be the one who does it. Sherry, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I'm calling because that really irked me. The Republicans and the Democrats at this very moment are practicing identity politics. They're trying to get the Trump voters, who are mainly white and feeling aggrieved. When you hear somebody say, I'm not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi when I get to Congress, and when you hear all the other kind of catchphrase words, that's identity politics. That's mainly appealing to white men who were Trump voters. I really, really hate the code words for Democrats should stop, doing this identity politics. That means that you're saying the Democrats should stop focusing on the needs of black and brown voters, whom are the majority of their base. They depend on them. And let's face it, they haven't really been very good lately about the needs of black and brown voters. Black people, and particularly black men during Obama's term, did not fare well in terms of jobs, in terms of training, in terms of policing. So, don't talk to me about dropping this identity politics and focusing on the economy. They're already doing identity politics.
Now, the Tom and Seabrights of the world, and I don't want to put words into, any one particular caller's mouth, but might say it's women and people of color who are particularly suffering from Republican economics. And so it's actually a unity kind of platform to run on Medicare for all, free college for all, the other things, that you might think of as Bernie Sanders issues.
Uh-huh.
And you don't have to talk about race, which might be politically divisive and turn off some white voters who might be also economically aggrieved and come into the camp, and that these are, economically unifying issues. What would you say back to that?
I would say to him, the fact that I get up in the morning, put my feet on the floor, and breathe is going to be offensive to somebody. I'm black, I'm gay, I'm a woman.
Sherry, thank you so much. Keep calling
us. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And as we run out of time with Elena Schneider from Politico, I want to ask you one thing about the Mueller investigation and the midterms. Another strand of news stories this week is about Trump's people pressuring Mueller to end the investigation. Rudy Giuliani was out doing this yesterday, for example, by September 1st, while at the same time they're using delaying tactics to make that impossible. And there's speculation that Mueller would like to complete his work by then, which I'm skeptical of. And, of course, the Mueller team doesn't say anything publicly anyway. But I would think Mueller would be content to take a time out on indictments during September to the midterms period, because he still has work to do and it's considered bad form and in some cases even illegal to do that too close if it involves somebody who's in an actual race, and then proceed to indict people either named Trump or not named Trump after that if the evidence warrants. I think the Mueller factor is already baked in politically to the midterms on both sides. And even indictments or report on the president's behavior won't change the polarized reality very much. But you're out there covering these midterm congressional races. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think it's baked in at this point. I think that the people who want the Mueller investigation to continue and expect it to bring indictments and think the president will be potentially taken out by it, they're already voting. In the same way, Republicans who feel like this is an attack from the deep state and that the president is completely innocent in this case, they also already believe that. I think that at this point, that we're not hearing a lot from candidates talking about this. I don't think that there's a real benefit to them most of the time to talk about the president's, about this investigation. I think that in a recognition that people already are self-aware enough and they want to redirect the conversation to something positive, if you're a Democrat, and for that matter, and if you're a Republican, they want to talk about the things that they can control and the selling points for their campaigns. And I think the Mueller investigation is often just a distraction for them.
So for some Democrats who might be listening and thinking, boy, you know, I really hope Mueller comes up with whatever he's going to come up with about Trump by September 1st so it can have an effect on the midterms. Wrong question?
I think it's tough to, like you said, we don't know what's going to come out of the Mueller investigation. So I think that that's a real gamble to bet the house on what kind of news might come from that. And it's still not clear what kind of effect it might have. And as you said, if things are baked in, then maybe it won't have much of an effect. But again, these are what if questions that seem almost too monumental and big to really come down on if you don't know what the actual results of the investigation might be.
Elena Schneider, campaign reporter for Politico, focusing on the House and Senate midterms right now. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me back.